like to acknowledge my co-authors and for their contributions to this presentation. The background of this presentation are the following four points. The global burden of disease from alcohol, increased consumption and high-risk drinking in Canada, and increased access to alcohol, and finally the economic costs that are associated with alcohol problems in Canada, estimated at $14.9 billion in 2002. Now, as you probably all know, there are many different ways of setting prevention priorities. You can consider the status quo is often the way to set a priority. Something is already there in place, and so you just continue doing this. There are values, ideology, and politics, and special interest groups that influence prevention. The damage from alcohol can be an important way of setting priorities, the size of the problem, the seriousness of the problem, the increase in damage and visibility, and the high-risk drinkers, the drinking context, the vulnerable populations, the costs, and of course, the potential for impact, evidence-based response is available, and the capacity to respond is available. And what I'm going to do now is talk about some survey data and some primarily mortality data with regard to alcohol problems in Canada. And then at the end, I'm going to look at what are the implications for prevention priorities, policy priorities in Canada. The first source of data is the Canadian Addiction Survey, which was conducted late 2003 and January to April 2004. There were 1,000 per province, and then total number of cases was 13,000, a response rate of about 47%, and through using random digit dialing techniques. This slide indicates the prevalence of by age and gender in the last year, people who had reported consuming alcohol in the last 12 months. I think in contrast to the United States, and maybe Tom Greenfield will be presenting some of that, our prevalence of consumption is quite a bit higher, with high percentage of people who actually drink in the past year. And this has been the case for a number of years. Slightly lower for the most 65 and plus, but not dramatically different. These are the percentage of people who say they consume 5-plus drinks on a weekly basis, and you can see that it's much more common among men than women, and much more common among younger adults, 15 to 24, that was the low level for the survey, and then it is for people, let's say, 65-plus, for example. With regard to the audit score, I don't think I need to explain that to people. The 8-plus is considered to be problematic drinking, and similar sort of pattern, if you will, very high score for males, 15 to 24, almost 37% are out about that, and then it drops off quite dramatically. Again, there's a pretty dramatic difference, about 1 to 3 ratio for males and females with regard to the audit score. Here's the percentage who exceeded the low-risk drinking guidelines in the past year. These guidelines are the Ontario-based guidelines. They are 14 drinks per week for men, no more than 14 drinks for men, no more than 9 for women, and a maximum of 2 per day. And we use these criteria to estimate what percentage of the population, what percentage of the people surveyed indicated that they had consumed more than that. And you can see that, again, 15 to 24 and 25 to 44, you have a fairly high percentage, like 30-plus for men or just over 25, and then it drops off somewhat, not as dramatically as, for some of the other indicators that I just presented. So both high-risk drinking patterns and overall consumption levels have been shown to impact chronic disease and other harm from alcohol. The results from the community health surveys, which I did not present, suggest that high-risk drinking has increased from 10% to 14% between 93 and 2004. The Canadian Addiction Survey found that 23% exceeded the lowest drinking guidelines. This is of past-year drinkers. The data I just showed was the total population, so this number is a little bit higher. And also 17% of past-year drinkers were considered to drink hazardously, using the alcohol use disorders identification test. So adjusting on for per capita consumption, this is the classification of drinkers in four categories, showing the males and females. The abstinence are very light drinkers. This is for Canada as a whole. And then the drinking category one, it is considered to be moderate drinking. And then hazardous drinking, and finally the harmful drinking. And these data were then used to create the relative risk, and the formula is presented here. I have only 15 minutes, so I won't read this page in great detail. And then they calculated the proportion of alcohol attributed mortality in years of life lost. And so you can see that of the overall alcohol attributed mortality, about 30% of this is for chronic disease only. Pardon me. About 35% are due to cancers. 22 for mental health, mental disorders. Pardon me. Digestive diseases, cardiovascular. And then the other side of the equation of the benefits, the majority are cardiovascular with some related to diabetes. And then the next column is the years of life lost for those age 70, less than 70, and with regard to chronic disease. So these results are presented. The absolute numbers are presented here. You can see that that cancer, digestive disorders, and cancers have about a similar number of cases in 2002, with somewhat less for alcohol dependence and other mental disorders. And then a small number for cardiovascular detrimental effects. Potential years of life lost. The patterns are somewhat similar with higher number for digestive disorders. And similarly, cardiovascular benefits, the number of cases are considered to have benefited from very moderate consumption. Okay, moving along rather quickly, I'm now going to look at these same data using the same sort of approach, but rather than absolute numbers, presented in terms of rates per 100,000 by age group and by gender. And this is all alcohol-related mortality for 2002 in Canada, and you can see that the numbers are higher, especially among men in the older age groups, than they are for the very, very young. Here we contrast the difference between injuries and violence and chronic disease, and as might be expected, the injury violence category is very, very high for the 15 to 44 year old age group, particularly for men, and it is still relatively high, if you can see down here, for the for the 45 to 69 year old age group, and then of course the chronic disease is elevated for that latter age group. We did not include 70 and older because the finding is that there's lots of problems with a cause of death diagnosis for those age 70 and over. There is of course a classification of cause of death, but it's often disputed as to whether how accurate it is. With regard to injuries and violence, you can see it is higher again 15 to 44, and then it drops off for those aged 45 to 69, and again the male-female difference is quite striking with regard to that category. There are some alcohol-related injuries for those under age 15, small number. Here we've looked at the chronic disease by the five most populous provinces, and there's not dramatic differences as is indicated here. Similarly with females, and now turning to specific chronic diseases, and you can see that the cancers again presented as rates per population by age group. The cancers and neuropsychiatric causes of death and digestive are the dominant ones, and there's some benefits with regard to cardiovascular for that age group, and a smaller proportion smaller rate, if you will, for the diabetes. But the overall picture is that the damage is much substantially greater than the benefits with using one criteria, basically operative mortality. For females, a similar picture, if you will. The numbers are lower. To go back here, for the damage, it's between 8 and 15 or so per 100,000. And for females, it's considerably less, between 5 and 6 for some of the, for cancers and so on. Okay. I'm going to have to move forward quickly since I think I'm... How's my time here? Okay. Thanks. Okay. I'm now going to look at a study that many of you may know about by Thomas Faber and colleagues. And this is Alcohol No Ordinary Commodity, published by Oxford about 4 years ago. And part of the study looked at different types of ways of intervening in policies. And we looked at these five, these categories and 32 policy-related prevention under these categories were evaluated in terms of evidence effectiveness, breadth of research support, test across cultures, and cost to implement and sustain them. We also had other considerations such as the target group, adverse side effects, population reach, feasibility. So this list here and these considerations went into assessing these 32 policy-relevant prevention strategies and interventions. And this led to the list of best practices using evidence-based, using the research, international research. Probably several thousand studies were looked at. As you can see, the list is quite diverse. I mean, there's some that focus on more individual interventions, such as brief interventions. A number focus on the drinking and driving arena, where there has been extensive work over the last 30, 40 years, and so it's not surprising that the evaluation has demonstrated some impact there. And then others focus on access to alcohol, the ones on this left-hand column. So, in conclusion, what I want to do is now focus on what is the relevance of these best practices to what we've just presented. We've presented information on damage from alcohol, trauma, and gender and age. And how are they relevant to that? And then secondly, how do these best practices fit with recent developments in Canada? So the ones with the asterisks are interventions, as I'm sure you all know, which were designed specifically to curtail drinking and driving. But they may also have some impact on chronic disease. And the ones that restrict access to alcohol, I think, there's literature to demonstrate that they have impact on both trauma and chronic disease. And for most of them, some potential impact for all major age groups and for both genders. So here's my attempt to answer our group's attempt to answer the second question is what is the current situation in Canada with regard to these 10 best practices? And the ones I've highlighted with an asterisk in blue are the ones that I think where there still needs to be a lot of work done, as is indicated. In government retailing, we do have some government control system, but the systems are mixed. There's pressure to increase access. There's extensive marketing, government liquor boards, and collaboration with the alcohol industries. Hours and days have been eroded as a control measure. Outlet density has increased. Wheel prices are declining. And there could be some further progress with regard to initiatives, with regard to brief intervention. So it seems like on the drinking and driving front, we have strong interventions, and on the other areas, these, by the way, are the ones that are really going to impact both trauma and chronic disease, the ones in blue. There needs much more work to be done in that arena. here is a model that has been developed by Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They rate the provinces, territories. I think a similar approach is used in the U.S. on a biannual basis. And as you can see, they have tried to rate the territory, the these five provinces. We just pulled these out with regard to different types of interventions. And I think that's a model that could be applied with regard to the other interventions as well. How well are the provinces doing with regard to the methods that are effective to control both trauma and chronic disease? We don't have that data handy, but I think it really points a way forward with regard to getting a better mix between the damage from alcohol and what sort of interventions have been shown to be effective, and whether the provinces and the municipalities are applying them as well as they might. So, there have been some recent developments, pardon the typo of spelling. A national alcohol strategy was developed in 2007, and this is the title of it. It contains 41 recommendations in four categories, and this is at the planning and implementation stage. The Alberta Drug Strategy provides a provincial framework for action on alcohol and other drug use. In British Columbia, there's a paper entitled Following the Evidence, Preventing the Harms and Substance Use in BC. And Ontario, there are deliberations underway with regard to provincial drug strategy. And Quebec has released an interdepartmental action plan on drug addiction. And Nova Scotia has just released an alcohol strategy. So in the last few years, there's been quite a bit of work at the provincial level with regard to, and at the national level with regard to looking at alcohol. But a lot of the recommendations have not yet been implemented. So to conclude, high-risk drinking is evident among a range of groups, but particularly among youth and younger adults. The damage from alcohol includes trauma and chronic disease, with about equal level of damage from each. Trauma is more common among young people, and chronic disease among older adults, not surprising. Our menu of response options with demonstrated impact is applicable to all ages, both genders, and a range of problems. However, in recent years, several goals most relevant to reducing alcohol-related chronic disease and high-risk drinking have been eroded. Therefore, in light of the increase in overall consumption that I mentioned at the outset and high-risk drinking, it is expected that damage and burden from alcohol will increase if things do not change. It is too early to say whether the strategies noted above at the national and provincial level will reduce overall consumption, high-risk drinking, and alcohol-related damage. But I think there's some cause for optimism. Thank you very much.